Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, a global movement that seeks to put children at the heart of any question around marriage and family. And today we are going to talk about our major project that we are launching in cooperation with dozens of other organizations. American Family Association is one of our cornerstone partners in this, as well as Focus on the Family, the Colson Center, the Family Research Council, and about a dozen other state-level organizations, and then maybe 20 other national organizations as well, who are all saying that gay marriage victimized children. Gay marriage actually reduced children to the status of commodities, and we are saying no more. So we're going to talk a little bit about that today. But we always kick things off with a little bit of Bible time. And I will tell you that as we have been preparing for this campaign to overturn Obergefell, something that none of the other 38 states across the globe that have legalized gay marriage has even attempted. And we've looked at the opposition that is going to be facing us. The book of Nehemiah has been instructive and inspiring to me as we build all of these coalition partners, as we think about strategy, as we are very clear-eyed about the kind of opposition that we're going to face. But there's one verse in particular that stands out to me every single time I listen to this book. And when I say listen to it, I mean that once or twice a week this week, I listen to the entire book of Nehemiah in the morning as I'm getting ready or at the gym. It washes over me and it fortifies me. And chapter 2, verse 20 says, "The God of heaven himself will prosper us. Therefore, we, his people, will arise and build." In Nehemiah's time, they had to rebuild walls of a literal city, a city that had been broken down. And when the walls were in shambles, that means the inhabitants of the cities could be ravaged and victimized. You need strong walls to protect the people inside. And that's what's happened with the institution of marriage. The walls have crumbled around marriage. And who are the inhabitants inside? Yeah, sure, the husband and wife, or the adults involved, but it is the children specifically who are at risk when the walls crumble. So what are we doing today? We, this week, have launched Greater Than. This is a campaign to retake marriage on behalf of children, to say children's rights, their need to their own mother and father, are greater than adult desires, adult agendas, adult feelings, adult so-called equality. Children need to be at the heart of this conversation about the definition of marriage in our country. And it's amazing to me because this coalition that we have put together comes from all corners of conservatism. We have Catholic and Protestant leaders involved. We've got pro-family organizations, conservatives. We've got social media influencers like Michael Knowles and Ali Stuckey and Lila Rose. And all of us are saying the same thing. We are saying, don't touch the kids. And that's what gay marriage did. It victimized children. It reoriented the law away from the fundamental realities and needs of children towards adult validation. So that is the verse that's on my mind as we go into this never before even tried effort to retake marriage on behalf of children. And Nehemiah is a constant encouragement to me in that effort. I'm joined by my training director, Jen Friesen, who is an integral part of this work. She runs all of our social media channels, and so she is interfacing with a lot of people that are cheering us on and people that are hexing us to fail. Jen, any thoughts as we launch this campaign to retake marriage on behalf of children? Is there any kind of inspiration or scripture that has come to your mind as it relates to this effort and this work that we're undertaking?
Yeah, you made me think of the maybe later passages in Nehemiah where they're building the wall with, you know, the trowel and the brick and the clay in one hand and the sword and the shield in the other hand. That's an interesting concept to think that they're trying to do something peaceful, really, which is building. It's defensive. They're trying to restore and shore up, but they have to have weapons in their hand as well, or weapons at the ready, because there were so many threats around them. I mean, they had physical threats against them that were going to try and stop them. And so it's interesting to consider what that means for us. Obviously, I'm not talking about carrying a sword anywhere, but we talked about this in a staff meeting, that we do need to be praying. We do need to be asking God for protection, even protection from our own failures, temptations, the ways that we might gravitate into sin, whether it's, you know, me wanting to really pop off on someone who's being critical online, or we talked about just different family things might be coming up, different hardships outside of work, that we do have to be cautious, because this is going to be a time of heightened, probably spiritual warfare. And so I was thinking about that. In addition to, I have a little trepidation about the maybe scrutiny or, you know, different things that external forces, like you got doxxed. I was like, Katie's kind of already gone through it, so maybe you don't feel the same level of fear. But I was thinking too, I was walking with a friend and I was like, my family members, I have friends, they didn't sign up for any of this because they know me. And the enemy, and I just mean that sort of in this, like, the people who really are instigated by the enemy to do evil things physically or just blowing people's lives up, don't care about any of that. They really do want to hurt people and make people afraid to stand up. And so I definitely feel that sense of wanting God's protection and just encouragement to be strong and courageous, to do what's right, whether we're afraid or not. There's not a better time to do it than right now. It doesn't feel, you know, it feels like the vibe shift, and there's so many people aligning. So many people have been in this battle for such a long time that it's time that we join. You know, like a Lila Rose or something, she's been at a Planned Parenthood pretending to be something else to expose them. That's very dangerous, scary work. So it's exciting to join and continue this fight in a public way, but there's also fear with it, and we just need God's protection and direction.
This is definitely an issue where you have to count the cost. And I think a lot of us who love scripture, which obviously you and I both do, we have thought about like suffering for Christ and seeing it as an honor and a privilege that we would count ourselves worthy to participate in the suffering for Christ. And I think that a lot of us have thought, well, that just means saying Jesus Christ is my Lord and Savior. The truth is that standing on your platform in social media or standing in a line at the grocery store saying Jesus Christ is my Lord and Savior, I think people will be like, okay, thanks for letting me know there. Okay. I don't think that's actually as high stakes as it relates to social backlash as saying children deserve, have a right to, and need their own mother and father. Therefore, gay marriage needs to be overturned. Which one of those two is going to elicit the most amount of rancor and require you to hold a sword in one hand? It's really not necessarily the questions of what is the nature of God? Like, who is Jesus? And did he come to die for us? And is God triune? And is he eternal? Those kinds of questions are so critical and so foundational. But also, the questions of what is the nature of God, actually not the primary battle that the Christian is facing today as it relates to interfacing with culture. What is the primary battleground? It is questions around what is the nature of man? What does it mean to be human? And the answer to that is you're made in God's image. You're made male and female, because that is true. We know that the nature of marriage is the union of one man and one woman for one lifetime. And we see the harms to children that go along with redefining that. So now making the truth claim about what it means to be human is actually the place where we need to prepare ourselves to count the cost. And a lot of us, I think, have said, I don't want to pay that cost, or I don't need to pay that cost, because ultimately I really just need to stand for the gospel. But Christians are supposed to advance justice. And one of the main ways that we have forsaken children and turned them over to injustice is by denying the God-ordained design for marriage between a man and a woman for one lifetime. So that's what we're working on. You can go to greaterthancampaign.com. You can look at the questions and answers that we've got there, the trailer video that we produced with Dr. Albert Mohler on it, and John Stone Street, and Tony Perkins at the Family Research Council, and Jim Daly at Focus on the Family, and Lila Rose, and Michael Knowles, and Ali Stuckey, and Josh Hammer. And I mean, you can see that kind of tight argument of what is marriage for and who is marriage for? And the answer is it's for kids. So we're going to bring that central focus back to the conversation around marriage.
Yeah. Katie, I'd love to know, and just for anyone who hasn't heard it, where did this idea, the idea of a marriage campaign, getting a coalition of all the biggest voices and names together to overturn Obergefell, where did that come from? Or why now? Why this year? Why did it start?
Yeah, well, you know what? The answer is it should have been last year. The answer is we started thinking about this just a couple months before the 10-year anniversary of Obergefell and went, wait a second. Nobody really has tried to overturn this or challenge it at all. Maybe we should do that. But that kind of a campaign, that kind of a coalition, that kind of a strategy, it takes quite a long time to develop. You know, we started thinking about this last April and May, really started to gather our core partners in the summer, started to anchor some of our strategies related to judicial strategies, a cultural strategy, figuring out what we need to do to fortify the church all last fall, gathering more coalition partners in November and December, drafting model legislation or suggested options for legislators at the very end of the year, working on that for a couple months, and then finally bringing even more people on board once we had a formulated plan at the early, early weeks of 2025, and then preparing everything we need to go live with a website and graphic design and the video and everything. So honestly, it's my fault that we were not ready with all of this 10 years ago on the 10th anniversary of Obergefell. I'm just a little late to the take sometimes. So we're going to do it 11 years after the legalization of gay marriage, which doesn't have the same kind of poetic ring to it, but, you know, better late than never.
Well, and we've kind of talked about, you know, if we could go back in time 10 years ago with the language that you've developed now, we might have been able to win the battle when we needed to. But also, like you've talked about, with getting doxxed and having, or doing your blog secretly, you worked through so many thoughts. You were challenged in so many ways that you had to rethink how you communicated things. That period of time, whether you want to say wilderness or whatever, I don't know, it was a time of preparation. So maybe all of this just had to happen and get us to year 11 before it was time. And maybe the administration, maybe it had to be Trump in office, or it's just interesting to think what things maybe had to be in place for it to be the right time. And we're hoping, God willing, it's the right time and that there will be a lot of traction with this.
I think there's some advantages to doing this today. I know that there are. One thing is we can see the things that don't work. What does not work when it comes to advocating for the marriage of one man and one woman in the legal space? What does not work is building a case based on Bible verses. That does not work. That's very compelling for the narrow sliver of Americans that see scripture as their ultimate authority. It doesn't work. It doesn't help. I'd say it actually takes you backwards when you're talking with somebody that doesn't recognize the Bible as authoritative. What else doesn't work? It doesn't work to say, we reject gay marriage because we want to protect a county clerk's religious liberty to not sign a marriage license. We reject gay marriage because we don't want to bake a cake or arrange flowers. I think religious liberty and freedom of conscience issues are preeminently important. It does not win when you are talking about persuading your countrymen, because what do they hear? They hear, oh, my brother who's been in a relationship with his partner for 15 years, they can't get married because you might lose your 501c3 status. That sounds very self-serving. So we learned what doesn't work. What does work is saying, hey, children have been victimized. And we didn't have to, you know, in 2015, many of us speculated about the harms to children. We now have 10 years of receipts showing how children have been victimized, how they've been reduced to legal accessories in policy because we've elevated a non-procreative understanding of marriage in law. And the other thing is, now, 10 years later, we've got our own media sources. Now, you know, in 2015, you had to rely on National Public Radio or CNN to give you a fair shake and like represent your side equally and beautifully. And they wouldn't, they didn't, they hated that. Now we've got the Daily Wire, we've got the Blaze, we've got American Family Radio. We have our own distribution channels to present our case honestly to our fellow countrymen in ways that I think is going to actually win. We're going to talk a little more about this in the next segment. Stay with us.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
We're back at Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, here with my training director at Them Before Us, Jen Friesen, talking about this massive national coalition that we launched this week to challenge gay marriage. The campaign is called Greater Than, and you can find all of us on social media at Make Kids Greater. Those are our handles. You can go to the website, greaterthancampaign.com. You can take a little quiz. How much do you really know about gay marriage? You can look at our trailer video that features Josh Hammer and Ali Stuckey and John Stone Street and Albert Mohler, and see what these major Christian leaders and conservative influencers have to say about how gay marriage victimized children. We want you to be informed about this because it has been this silent killer as it relates to child rights in the law over the last 10 years. And nobody has raised a finger to try to reverse it. So that is what we are attempting to do with our Greater Than campaign. We want you to go over there, greaterthancampaign.org, join our newsletter, follow us on social media. We're attempting to do what no other country has ever done before, which is, in essence, reverse the revolution of the earth. That's kind of the legal equivalent of what we're doing. We're going to cause the law to spin, not backwards, but forward again, right? The legal world of marriage and family has been spinning backwards for the last 10 years, and we have to set that orbit right again. So Jen, you've been a part of a lot of this, our working groups, obviously our effort to push things out on social media this past week. What have you thought about this so far? What did you first think when we said, actually, one of our biggest projects is going to be, yeah, let's overturn gay marriage? I mean, what were your thoughts when we first decided to do this as an organization?
I felt amazed that we thought to do it. It makes me feel like I get to be on the cusp of something that is historical. I was talking about this with friends the other day that I had used in arguments on Twitter that I thought Roe was going to be overturned in my lifetime. It seemed like the science was just becoming undeniable. The technology was getting better and better. Young people were becoming pro-life. I was like, it's going to happen in my lifetime. I was pretty confident about that. I didn't think it was going to happen 5 years ago or 2 years ago. I don't even remember the exact date, but the fact that it got overturned and returned to the States in my lifetime when I'm young enough to be interested and still tweeting about it, I thought was phenomenal. And to think that we are kind of the equivalent of those people who, when Roe v. Wade got established by the Supreme Court, they said, okay, then this is the start of the pro-life movement and the start of the fight. And that's what it feels like we're doing right now for marriage. And now I was thinking, you know, if a cynical person asked you, you think you're going to get Obergefell overturned this year? Are we like, yeah, totally, that could happen? Or are we thinking, look, it doesn't actually matter to us how long it takes. It might be 75 years, but we're going to build this into like the fabric of politics. That's what the pro-life movement became, like the fabric of. To be a conservative Republican, you had to sign off and check the box that you were pro-life. And it would be fascinating if that was the amount of influence that this became.
It better not take 75 years. It's going to take more than one, though, that's for sure, because the fermentation of Obergefell has worked itself through federal law and state level laws. It's contaminated several different judicial rulings that have rolled down in the last 10 years, and it's going to take some time to reverse that. But the good news is we've got truth on our side. We have objective truth on our side. And I think that one of the reasons why we're going to succeed is because it is a truth that's self-evident. Even more than children have a right to life when they're a five-day-old blastocyst. We know that children come from a man and a woman, and we've met those kids who have been harmed when they've lost their mother or father. I think that there's a lot of people in the country that would say, oh, I support gay marriage because they think it's about helping gay people. But I think that of the vast majority of those people would also say, oh, of course children need a mother and father. Of course moms and dads are important to kids. They just don't know that they cannot hold both of those thoughts simultaneously. They have to choose. I support gay marriage or kids need a mom and dad. And I think that once we make the case to them, a lot more of them will go, objectively, kids need a mom and dad. And if that means that we can't have gay marriage, I guess we can't have gay marriage because children come from a man and woman and they need that man and woman. So I'm very optimistic. And I wonder if I wasn't around when the pro-life movement was born. I don't feel like I've even been at the center of a lot of what they've done because we've been so busy with the work of defending children's right to their mother and father. I feel like I've been kind of have a front row seat to the right to life arguments that have been taking place. But I don't know if even the pro-life world has ever had the kind of singular messaging and focus that we have at the Greater Than campaign that we have been able to build, because we have set right from the outset, you know, when I was inviting partners in and allied organizations and coalition members into this effort, I said very clearly, I said, here's the parameters of the work that we're doing. This will be about child victimization. We are not going to talk about religious liberty matters. We are not going to quote chapter and verse. Everything we're doing is going to be about child victimization. What does that mean? That means that we are not going to use the word sodomite or degenerate or suggest that all people who experience same-sex attraction or identify as LGBTQ are abusers, because that results in people feeling like it's the gays that are being victimized by us. We are never going to give anybody an excuse to believe that gays are the victims. Also, you and I, we all have friends that identify as gay and lesbian, and they deserve to be spoken of and thought of with dignity. But we are never going to flinch or relinquish our critical drive to defend children. So that means we're going to go into some very unpopular territory. So we were able to, before we started this effort, set down kind of the rules of operation for everybody that joined our coalition, knowing that everything that comes out of Greater Than HQ is going to singularly focus on child protection. That will be our one message. And as a result, we've been able to build this huge coalition. We've probably have 70 partners, individuals and organizations. More than 40 of them are represented on the website. There's three more that agreed this morning. I mean, it's just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Why? Because we've been very clear right from the beginning about exactly who we are and what we're going to be saying and what we're not going to be saying.
That's so good. And I know that we, part of building this coalition, you did what you called working groups. And I can think of, I think three. I think you had like a judicial legislative working group, a cultural working group. I think you had a religious one as well. Can you talk a little bit about why you had those working groups? And then were you a part of each of those conversations? And what was sort of the different strategies and arms of what Greater Than is hoping to achieve, like through the different facets, I guess, of culture?
We knew right from the beginning that we would never succeed unless we were successful in three different arenas. First, we needed a judicial strategy that actually had the possibility of success. One of the reasons why nobody has tried this in America for the last 10 years is because nobody could figure out what that pathway was. I had talked to people in the policy space, people at the heads of different organizations, and I had asked them over the years, why isn't anybody working to overturn Obergefell? These are like lawyers, constitutional lawyers. And they would say to me, it can't be done. It's impossible. And I've spent some time learning and studying and then talking to other legal voices and realized they are right. It can't be done if we do it the way we've always done it. So we're going to do it differently. And if you are a state level lawmaker that would like information about that, you can go to our website and send us a message and we will read you in to some of the ways that can be done and give you some specific direction if you'd like to be a part of this. But the overall judicial explanation is Obergefell required that we flatten any familial distinctions in law. You could not recognize gender in family law, so you had to remove words like mother and father and replace it with parent one and parent two or guardians. You couldn't recognize that biology was an important part of the parent-child relationship. That was just like adoption. And it was just like intent-based parenthood or de facto parenthood, where somebody could just claim to parent a child if they were married to the child's other parent, or they created that child through reproductive technologies. Infertility was redefined. So now it wasn't a medical condition. Now it was a social condition, so that insurance companies were required to subsidize the manufacturing of motherless and fatherless children for same-sex couples. What you see is like a complete neutralizing of any of these distinctives of the family in law that children, that really matters to children. So what is our judicial strategy? It's simply to force those distinctions to reemerge in law. Insist that we use the words mother and father, not parent one and parent two. Insist that only biological parents go on the birth certificate. You can't just put an unrelated adult on there as if they have a claim to the child. Prioritizing, elevating, incentivizing a child's own mother and father married and raising them together. Once you insist on those biological realities outlined in law, you are going to fundamentally undermine Obergefell and really cause the courts to make a choice. Are they going to value children's right to their own mother and father? Or are they going to say that a state-assigned adult who's unrelated to them offers just as much benefit to kids? And the answer is obviously no, they don't. So that's the judicial strategy that we have been working on over the last few months. But we also realized it wasn't enough to just have a credible pathway for judicial success. We need to change public opinion. We need to change the way Americans think about marriage. And so we got this amazing coalition of influencers from, you know, Michael Knowles and Ali Stuckey and Lila Rose and Josh Hammer to Ron Coleman and Heidi St. John and Abby Johnson and Delano Squires and the Babylon Bee guys, you know, to all get in this coalition. And their job is to help people immediately connect the dots between gay marriage and child victimization, and natural marriage and child protection. So hopefully you're going to see a lot of voices in the conservative space making that explicit case over the next few weeks and years.
I was just thinking that you made a point that we have our own media now. It's the new media. I think Daily Wire is a great example of that. The Babylon Bee is a different kind of media, or not the Bee. We have more freedom on X now. And so the mainstream, sort of those big news organizations, don't control all the streams of how you get to people anymore. Yeah. But it's fascinating to think. I think Ali B. Stuckey said this because there's a lot of debate in this current moment about immigration and ICE. And she was talking about it's my job to help women, like white, more liberal women or very empathetic Christian women, are really buying what's happening hook, line, and sinker. And Ali wasn't saying we need to do propaganda, but she's saying we have to improve our messaging to win people over to the right way of thinking. So I love that we have those people now because of the work they've been doing for decades, you know, a decade and however long for different groups. And they've put blood, sweat, and tears to establish their audiences. And then the smart thing in our job is getting all of them together and equipping them with one singular message, help us translate this to your people, is going to be huge. That's how you change. We talk about we want to change hearts and we want to change hearts and minds. And you do need both. It can't just be, let's do bleeding heart, get people on our side, and we have no legal strategy. And it can't just be the law. If people, we're seeing that a little bit with abortion as well, right? There's a lot of states where the hearts have not been changed yet. Okay. And then, sorry, I interrupted you, but the final group I think you were going to say was a religious group.
Yeah. All right. We have a church working group where we've got leading Protestants and leading Catholics that are working to create materials that communicate what the church teaches, what the Bible prescribes for marriage, but then goes beyond that and talks about what we know about the social science and why. You know, there's three distinct characteristics of marriage that is outlined by Christ when he's challenged by the Pharisees, but they're like, hey, divorce, what do you think? He says, a man shall leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife. The two shall become one flesh. What God has joined together, let no man separate. What three characteristics from marriage do we hear in that one verse? Number one, that it's complementary. There is complementarity there. It's male and female. Number two, that it's monogamous. It is a one flesh union. There's only two people in it. And number three, it's supposed to be permanent. So each of those three different attributes of marriage has a very specific child benefit. And compromising on any of those, the permanence through no-fault divorce, the complementarity through gay marriage, or the monogamy through polyamory or polygamy or extramarital affairs or premarital sex, all of that implicates and damages children. So we are going to make the case that the family, that marriage as God intended, is God's plan A for child protection. And then we are going to tell the church that their primary job is not to be welcoming and affirming of adults. It is to be protectors of children. And then we're going to make the case from scripture and from history that this is one aspect of our pure and undefiled religion before God. This is what Christians have done everywhere all throughout the centuries. And we hope that as a result of the materials we're creating, we will turn the church into a child-centric fighting force.
Maybe really quick, you could answer an objection that maybe some of our listeners, Christian listeners or religious people might think is, why can't the state just stay out of marriage? Marriage is a God thing. God created it. It's for the church to talk about and decide. And we don't want to get involved with this campaign because we don't want the state involved in marriage at all. What's our response to that?
It's a question that a lot of people have, and I would encourage you to go to Greater Than Campaign, and you can go to the Learn More tab. We've got a whole section of Q&A, and that's one of the questions that we answer. And then, in essence, the answer is, oh, you don't want the state involved in marriage. What does that mean? I mean, does the state then not legally define what is a parent and what is a child? Is there no definition of spouses? Are they supposed to completely get out of questions about alimony or custody? I mean, what that means is the state is not involved in reinforcing the true definitions of marriage and all the accompanying relationships. Somebody will define them. It's just going to be a definition that is much farther away from the realities that are going to be child protective and elevate that institution into one that actually serves all of society, not just the adults involved. So, you know, we conclude that question with, if you want the government out of marriage, don't think that leads to freedom, that leads to tyranny. That's what it does. So if you have other questions, there's a really good chance that we also address to those. There's a really good chance that we also address those. Come to Greater Than Campaign, learn more, sign up, and join us.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Welcome to Here for the Comments with Jen and Sam, the Greater Than edition. You just heard an update from Katie about Greater Than launching this week. And so Sam and I are super excited to talk about a few of the big questions that come up when we talk about marriage and the redefinition of marriage that happened with Obergefell. So Sam, I'm excited to chat with you today. How are you doing?
Doing good. Today's the day. We've been working towards this day for quite a while, so we're very excited about this launch. I think this campaign is going to go far.
We are excited, and Sam is particularly excited for the people who are going to be pushing back, because you must get excited about like engaging with people. I think that's probably why you like Twitter and being online, yeah?
It's true. I don't know. There's just something about people coming at it where it's like, you just get to, you get to use humor to combat some of the comments that people have coming at you. So I enjoy it.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right. Well, on the website, greaterthancampaign.com, there's a gay marriage quiz that I think we're going to have Sam take live next time. But there's also an answering hard questions section, which will be really helpful for folks. But we're going to do kind of an audio version of it and see how far we get and just talk through some of these main objections to redefining, well, we would say returning to the original definition of marriage, but the problems with redefining marriage with Obergefell, what kind of things it caused. So the first question is a good one that we get a lot of pushback using this question. Do you believe gay people are bad parents that don't love their kids? What's your initial thought on that question, Sam?
Okay, so I like the response that we have on here. Basically, a woman who identifies as a lesbian, she could actually be a really loving mother, but she can never be a father. And the guy who identifies as being gay, he could be a really loving father, but he'll never be able to be a mother. So a woman cannot be a man cannot be a woman. And we are different. We have different gifts that we can give to our children, and they can't just be swappable. So yeah, I'd say it doesn't mean that you're a bad parent. It just means that something's missing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We actually get folks, I think on the more conservative side, who say, well, no, you can't be a good parent because you identify as gay. Or they are referencing things like the folks who have used a sperm donor or an egg donor. That therefore means you're a bad parent. And while we would agree that these things are not ideal for children, identifying and living your life as a gay, lesbian, trans, et cetera, I would say that's objectively not good for you and your human flourishing. And it's not good for kids. But we can still acknowledge that people could still be doing their best, that people could still genuinely love the kid that's in their care. And you have to think too, when we're thinking back to the 90s and the 2000s and earlier, people who identified as gay and lesbian, these were often their biological children. They'd probably been married to someone of the opposite sex before. And so definitely when we're talking about a biological connection, it's much more common, of course, to love the children that came from you. And we're not saying that someone who's not biologically related to you can't be a safe, healthy, loving person. But we're always going to come back to what's the ideal for children. And you said it perfectly. The reality is when you see a child raised by two men or two women, you're seeing a child that lost something, period.
Yeah.
It's just obvious. It doesn't mean they're objectively bad people. We're not saying they're all abusers. But we're looking at the kid first. We're not looking at the adult identity first. How can we make them feel better about it? We're saying, how does the kid feel? What are the kid's natural rights?
Yeah.
What's the next question we got here?
All right. Next question is, would children be better off in foster care instead of being in a loving home with the same sex parent? What do you think, Jen?
I love that we talk about adoption and foster care from a really important perspective. This is not going to surprise anyone. From the kid's perspective, these institutions exist to protect children. The child is the client in these things. But also, this question is begging the question in the sense of we're comparing oranges to apples, right? We're saying, well, the alternative is you either get to be raised by same-sex parents or you're in a foster home forever. And we can say, oh, you know, there's things that are not ideal about being in foster care forever. Maybe there are some scenarios where it's better to be with a single individual or with someone who identifies as gay, even if we think about kinship bonds, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But can we still acknowledge the ideal for kids? If you're in an adoptive situation, you've already lost something. If you're in foster care, you've lost something. You know, do you have anything to add to that one?
Yeah, basically just when you see those situations, both of those situations show a broken home. And what we're saying is that if we can avoid a broken home, that's what we want to see. We want to see, like you said, the ideal. And that's the difference between, say, like surrogacy or donor conception versus adoption. Whereas like adoption, we didn't purposely create this child ahead of time wanting them to go into a broken home. And something happened along the way where we are trying to fix and find the best home for that child after the fact, versus surrogacy and donor conception, where that's the game plan. That's the whole point, is we want to break a child's home so that way we get what we desire in the process, which is our own child in our own home, even though that child does have a biological mom or a biological dad out there in the world that they may never know.
Yeah, exactly. All right. The next one is, how does my gay loved one's marriage affect anyone else?
Okay. So what we would say to that is that even if a married same-sex couple doesn't have children, the legal existence of same-sex marriage requires the redefinition of legal parenthood in a way that makes a child's mother or father optional. And so that's how it still hurts society as a whole. You know, again, I hate this whole, I feel like a lot of us used to believe, at least I did, you know, whatever happens behind closed doors, it doesn't affect me. That's fine. I don't want the government to have overreach, but we don't live on an island. We're not by ourselves. We live in a society, and what we do, like, it does affect other people. And again, we have this whole class of the most vulnerable in our society, which is children. And they've been way overlooked all of this, you know, all these years, which is the exact reason why Katie felt the need to start Them Before Us, is because no one was sticking up for these children, representing these children and speaking out for these children. And we have plenty of like studies, and we know that this is affecting them and hurting them. So that's how it affects other people.
Yeah. It's one of my most, the most irritating things people say online are things like, if you don't like gay marriage, don't get gay married. If you don't like abortion, don't have one. It's like, okay, let's take this logic. You don't like murder, don't murder. But it's okay if other people murder. If you substituted other things in, it just doesn't make sense. I mean, personally, I don't like murder. But if other people, it's kind of like, it's their body, their choice kind of thing. It's just absurd, right? It's
yeah. Like, I wouldn't want to judge a murderer.
Yeah. You don't like slavery, don't have a slave. Okay, no, I'm saying it's wrong for you to have a slave too. Like yeah. You said, we're in a society where things intersect. And we are not saying that we want the government to come and make sure people can't do XYZ in their bedroom, consenting adults. But we're saying to call it marriage is something completely different than not caring what consenting adults, like, they can live and love who they choose, but you don't get a government stamp of approval on every random different kind of proclivity. That doesn't make sense. It does. It's the government is supposed to promote human flourishing and the greater good of society, and gay marriage objectively does not do that. And we talk about that a ton in all these other resources on the website.
Yep. All right, next question. Do same-sex couples have a right to parenthood?
The super short answer to this is no. Gay people don't have a right to kids. But it's like, oh, it's because straight people don't have a right to children either. Nobody has a right to children. Well, and we specifically say no one has a right to children that are not biologically yours. You should have the right to create your children with your one other person and raise your children. Of course, the government shouldn't be able to take them away from you. But this is saying, do I have the right to kids that don't belong to me, that I had to borrow and buy and rent different parts and pieces so I could create the child I wanted? So yep. Children have a right to their mother and father. Random adults don't just have rights to get children however they want just because they can write a check, you know, cash a check. Do we even do checks anymore? Because they can swipe a credit card.
Yeah. And I think Katie said it best. She was in an interview once where the interviewer asked her, why are you trying to ban me from having kids? And mm-hmm. She basically said, like, it's not me banning you from having kids. Biologically, you and another male, if you are the same sex, you cannot have children. It's your own biology. It's your own body. It's just how nature works. It's us just recognizing that reality and saying, so in order for you to have a child, that inherently means that a child isn't the result of you and your partner. It's the result of either you and somebody else or somebody else and their partner, or, you know, it's not your kid in the first place. And so that's the main issue.
Yeah, that's good. All right. Don't the studies show that children with same-sex parents fare just as well as those raised by their mother and father? The science is settled, Sam.
Yeah, yeah. We've heard it all, haven't we? If you Google it, maybe that's what you would see. But the problem is, you know, this is a long-term campaign that they've started. So every credible source proves that the biological connection is what advantages, you know, it gives children an advantage. Mothers and fathers offer distinct and complementary benefits, and parent, when you lose a parent, you immediately have some kind of diminished outcome or loss. The studies of same-sex households, which are usually missing a biological parent, maternal or paternal love, in which the child has suffered parental loss, they largely suffer from poor methodology. I don't know if I said that right. Methodology. I don't think it's methodology.
Yeah.
Poor method.
Yeah, we talk about when the studies, someone will show us the study and we go and look at the details and it'll say 60. This is just, I'm kind of just making numbers off the top of my head, but this is exactly what happens. It's a certain number that's low. 20 couples, 30 couples, women who responded to an advertisement to lesbian women. So they were recruited specifically. Like saying, you identify as lesbian, we want you in this study. And then they're given a survey and told, how good is your child doing as you're raising them as a same-sex parent or a same-sex couple? Tell us how good of a job you're doing. Tell us how what the outcomes for your kids are. That's some of the studies. So imagine you're a parent who identifies as gay. You got recruited into a study to study your parenting, and you're given a survey where you self-rate your parenting and how well your kid's doing. And then we're surprised when the rating is, my kids are great and I'm doing a great job. There might be a place for surveys. There might be a place for recruiting.
Yeah.
But that can't be what we've hinged everything on. And the exact same thing would be true about heterosexual parents. Like, I was homeschooled. If I told people homeschooling was awesome only because a study that recruited homeschooling parents that were told, hey, tell us how good of a job you're doing. And they all said, we did great. 100% of homeschooling kids are doing awesome. And people would laugh me out of the room. And homeschooling kids actually are doing awesome. And I will go to bat for that every single time. But there's good data that says that. It's not just someone saying, yeah, I think I'm awesome. There, that's the science. Now we're going to change all of public policy to reflect the personality of 20 people who did a survey to prove that their kids were fine, right? So we need better science. Hey, I'd love to get some better science on that, but those studies don't get funded and published because people are scared. What's gonna happen?
Yeah, it's easier to say that we don't see any issues with it, but because you purposely refuse to actually study it. So they can write it off as saying like, oh yeah, no, there's no study that says it's bad for kids. Well, that's because you won't do a study because you know that it's going to be bad for kids.
Right. Well, and to your point, it's bad when a kid loses a parent to death. It's bad when they lose them to divorce and they get split up time. And those things, it's the exact same thing has to happen when you're with a same-sex couple. You've lost your parents somehow, but suddenly, magically, the results are totally different. In our final minute, let's skip down to the, shouldn't the government just get out of the marriage business altogether?
Yeah. So what we ask you is, what does that even mean? Is there no legal status of marriage? Is the family no longer real? And there's no protection for husband, wives, or kids? And basically, it's like that's not a realistic thing that you actually believe when you say that. It's not a real response because marriage is already involved with the government. You know, we already go to the government and we ask if get married, we get a license, we sign contracts. And so you're very comfortable with that. But this is just an easy response to try to avoid the actual argument about whether or not this is actually what marriage is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. Well, and actually, I do want to hop down to the last one because I think this is important because we get this all the time. I think it's so stupid. Overturning gay marriage threaten interracial marriage? The really short answer is Dennis Prager, I remember, answered this to Perez Hilton, who is a gay blogger guy. And he said, there is no fundamental difference, really, no significant difference between a black man and a white man. There just isn't. The amount of melanin in your skin is the difference. But there are huge differences between a man and a woman. So someone being against interracial marriage is only against it because of melanin. People being against same-sex marriage is because we are saying a man and a woman aren't just interchangeable, valueless beings, and they matter to children.
A child can only come from a man and a woman. So this has nothing to do with being interracial or not, because interracial couples can create children. And that's the bedrock of a marriage.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right, guys, go to greaterthancampaign.com. Learn more. Follow us at Make Kids Greater on all the socials. And we will see you guys next time.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.